Hey, welcome to the Folk School Radio Hour. I'm Julie Tomorrow, and I am joined here in studio with Jacob Hunt, who is the executive director here at the Driftless Folk School. Jacob, I'd love it if you could just introduce yourself, tell everyone a little bit about yourself, kind of your connection to Driftless Folk School, and I know you are involved in many more things beyond just the Folk School. So go, give it a go.
Well, thank you, Julie. It's great to be back here. I think we talked on the first episode of the Folk School Radio Hour, and
yeah.
It's gone on to great and wonderful things.
So. Yeah, that's a do listen to episode if people are kind of just catching up now and curious about the big picture. But we'll get a little bit into that today because that's kind of related to our conversation today. So yeah.
Well, so as Julie said, my name is Jacob Hunt. I'm the executive director of the Driftless Folk School and Thoreau College, which is a single nonprofit offering grassroots hands-on education for people of all ages here in Viroqua and the Driftless region. I grew up here on a dairy farm, went to school in Viroqua, and I grew up doing many of the things that we teach in the Driftless Folk School, both in at home and in school, and so a lot of it comes naturally. But the Driftless Folk School is, maybe people can start getting hyped up for this, is going to turn 20 years old in January of 2026.
That's amazing, I think.
Yeah.
A celebration is in order.
Yeah, yeah. So this has now become a pillar of the local community, and it's really an honor to have been there at the beginning and still connected here today. So the Driftless Folk School is an important part of my life. And then for the last 5 years, it also has been connected to Thoreau College, which is, the other part of what I do, Thoreau College is a micro college. We stage gap semesters and summer programs and other shorter programs for young adults. We offer academics, folk arts and crafts, immersions in nature, academics and community life. So students from all over the world, these are college accredited classes as of this year. And we often, weave together the folk school instructors into these programs for the Thoreau students, bring them in during the weekdays, and also have the Thoreau students and our fellows participate in the folk school classes that happen on the weekends primarily. So
yeah, it's very expansive programming that you've got there, and then how it kind of weaves into with the folk school classes.
Yeah. As we'll hear, I think, in our conversation today, what we're doing with Thoreau College as a part of Driftless Folk School is really bringing the folk school idea back to its roots in Europe. We're doing something pretty unique. There are, approaching 100 folk schools in North America right now, some really awesome ones in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, and in Minnesota especially, but all over the country. But really the roots go back to Denmark and Scandinavia and programs for young adults actually.
Yeah, and that is kind of why you're here today is this trip that you just took, networking and meeting with and going to talks with and by people who do similar but regionally appropriate things all over the world. Tell me about this event that you went to, this conference.
Yeah. Well, so just to put the name out there, and we'll work up to what actually it was. The event was a really exciting, kind of first of its kind event. There was a predecessor that happened maybe 7 or 8 years ago in Denmark, but this was an international gathering called the International Folkemøde. That's Danish. Folkemøde for Educators. And it was held at a folk high school in Denmark called the International People's College, which is located in the small city of Elsinore, which is about an hour north of Copenhagen, famous for having the Castle of Hamlet.
Oh, there we go.
So, But yeah, this is an event that brought together people from all over the world, educators working in some way connected with this folk school idea. And, you know, as we'll talk about, the breadth of things that people are actually doing at their home institutions, you know, all over the world really shows the richness of these ideas. Because there's a lot of different kinds of things, different kinds of age groups, different kind of context. But this was a group of people that really instantly had a lot to talk about. And you could see the commonality, even despite that diversity of experience, of practice. But just to take it back to the beginning, so when I was first introduced to the idea of folk schools back when we were getting started back in 2006, I had never heard of folk schools, never heard of what they call them in Denmark, folk high schools. I was interested in alternative colleges, micro colleges, coming out of my own college experience, but I ran into, you know, people here in the Viroqua area who knew a lot about folk schools, especially the North American style folk school, like the Driftless Folk School. Several people who had taught at some of the older and more established folk schools, mm-hmm. especially the John C. Campbell Folk School, which is sort of the oldest in North America, located in Brasstown, North Carolina, and Tillers International over in Michigan, which is a little bit different than most other folk schools in really teaching, you know, homesteading skills for, you know, primarily. You know, initially for people in developing countries, animal power, blacksmithing, these sorts of things, timber framing, different kind of green building techniques, but also, you know, much like valued in this country as well. And then also in the Midwest, we have the North House Folk School up in Grand Marais, Minnesota, which is very much on the John C. Campbell model and was a great look to as a model then. So I'd never heard of these institutions. They were, you know, they're here in North America. They're primarily... you know, they're like the Driftless Folk School. They're offering hands-on classes for adults in folk arts and crafts, homesteading skills, sometimes music. But for shorter periods of time, maybe up to a week, but most of these are one session or 2 day classes, as we do through the Driftless Folk School. And these, you know, this movement that has really burgeoned since 2006, you know, we were at the very beginning of a wave that has now added dozens of other folk schools. And some of these actually, gathered, in last month, in Dodgeville at the Folklore Village. And that was a North American gathering of this folk school movement.
Yeah, it's great how these organizations kind of see their peer organizations, and there's a lot of like communication around, you know, how are you doing this? What is your model for that? Like, how do you build the curriculum? How do you, you know, make things affordable? All these kind of conversations that are mutually beneficial, and it's great that people are getting together.
I would say that's actually a relatively new thing, right?
Yeah.
I think as, you know, being part of the Driftless Folk School these last 20 years, most of that time we were kind of on our own, or it felt like it, right? Figuring stuff out, how do we actually, you know, fund these classes? How do we staff the programs? Mm-hmm. Who, you know, how do we set up some sort of a balanced kind of set of offerings? Those are things that felt like we were just having to figure them out. And it turns out those are very similar questions to which dozens of other people are asking. So meetings like these, like the Folk School Alliance gathering in Dodgeville and this gathering I went to in Denmark, are a really, I think, palpable steps forward in the building of a movement and the sharing of knowledge and skills and inspiration that I think is really a powerful step forward for the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, it feels like in this 20 years that this movement has been growing and really ramping up, and some of these folk schools that are now part of this wider network are much newer. Like the Driftless Folk School is not old like some of these ones that are over 100 years old, but is kind of old compared to some of these ones that have just started in the last 5, 10, maybe 15 years. And I know there's even some that started just this year, it's growing. So it makes sense that they're now this networking is also growing.
Yep. Yeah. We get, you know, contacted all the time by people asking how we do things, how people thinking about starting new ones. So it's an exciting moment to be involved in this movement. And I think that what we're doing, Julie, what you're doing with this radio show, and that what I'm doing with the Microcollege podcast is really it's a useful tool for many people. I know that I get contacted by people who are listening to the interviews that I do and who are really grateful to have that information out there.
Yeah. Well, you know, the time is ripe for these kind of skills, this kind of connection, this kind of community building, this kind of slowing down, purposefulness. I think that people are seeking that out, so it makes sense that these things are growing. So this conference you went to was not so well. Was it more for folk schools, or is it more like the micro college, like the Thoreau College model, where it's young adults? Like what kind of diversity of institutions were at this international gathering?
So this is an interesting thing. It's all of the above, and plus a few we haven't talked about yet. So maybe it probably makes this the most sense to start with like what we're talking about in Denmark and the historical background here, because I think it's an inspiring and powerful story that I'd really like more people to know about.
Mm-hmm.
I think really important for us to know about right now, and the sense that we have in our country here right now of real cultural crisis and social conflict and questions about how do we build a culture that will be sustaining for the people,
because sustaining and meaningful.
Yeah, so if you go back to the folk school idea, it goes back to the early 19th century in Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And so today, I think you think about Denmark and the other Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, we kind of take it for granted that they are wealthy countries, they have strong social safety net, they have a lot of egalitarian kind of social structure, and regularly they're rated as the best places to live. High rates of happiness, life expectancy, quality of life, all these things, the top countries in the world are these countries that kind of switch around positions. So, when we think about, how did they get to be that way? We can think, here in Vernon County, we have a lot of immigrants from Norway. Sometime in the 19th century, people were leaving these countries in droves to come here, right? It was,
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just the weather, because they came places with colder weather. those countries were very poor. They were actually poorer than the countries of Southern Europe. There's been a big reversal in that. And they were also very socially stratified, right? These were more or less medieval monarchies, absolute monarchies,
mm-hmm.
With a very, very small aristocratic kind of group of landowners. And, the peasants, right, the ancestors of most of the people who came here to Vernon County and in the upper Midwest, they were serfs. They were like Russia or, medieval France, something like this. They were tied to the land without any civil rights of any meaningful kind.
Yeah, and we're talking like mid-1800s.
Yeah, so there's a gradual transition. The late, the end, at the time, let's say, of the, of the American Revolution and the beginning of the 19th century, this is the conditions that were there, and really into the middle of the 19th century. So the other thing, in Denmark specifically, you had a dramatic kind of geopolitical crisis. Denmark was on the wrong end of a couple of military situations, most notably the Napoleonic Wars.
Mm-hmm.
The British came in and bombarded Copenhagen and took their whole fleet. Then Bismarck in the middle of the 19th century came and took a big chunk of southern Denmark. And so the country was actually losing territory significantly.
Yeah.
Its economic structure, which was based on global trade, was being shut down by the British and other kinds of structures. And Denmark is a country that is sort of very poor in natural resources. And even today, it doesn't have any oil. It didn't have very much timber. It was,
fishing.
It was, and not even, fishing, right? It was cut off in some ways by these other more maritime countries. So, bad neighborhood at that time and a few kind of assets to play.
Mm-hmm.
So how did it get to be, one of the more successful countries in the world? So that's the context to remember as we're talking about this.
Yeah.
So starting in the middle of the 40s and 50s of the 19th century, the 1840s and 50s, there was a movement that was initiated by a really remarkable historical figure, kind of the founder of modern Danish culture, you could say, who was a real eccentric guy, the Danish pastor, but also a translator of the Norse myths and just a social innovator, a writer of poems and hymns, named Nikolai Frederik Severin Grundtvig. Which you probably have never heard of Grundtvig.
That's Doozy of a name.
People have heard of a few Danes, Hans Christian Andersen, maybe Kierkegaard, the philosopher.
Of course, yeah.
And these were contemporaries, actually. There was interesting things going on in Danish culture. But
yeah.
in Denmark, right, Grundtvig is the person who's, you know, who stands at the beginning of the modern development of Denmark.
Yeah, okay.
And his observation was, you know, if we have a country that is starting to democratize, you know, it's starting to have the land is being distributed to the peasants. How do you get to the point to have a modern country without a bloody revolution? And this
right.
is another thing to note about Denmark. Unlike France or most other countries in the world, it went from this transition from really a feudal aristocracy to a very egalitarian social democracy today without a revolution.
Yeah.
Like almost yeah. no... There was almost no violence at all in this process. No heads were rolled. And they still have one of the oldest monarchies in Europe still.
Mm-hmm.
The same family on the throne for 1,000 years, but no
wow.
revolution
yeah.
in the middle, and very yeah. you know, very much a beloved monarchy. So that's very unusual. How did that happen?
Yes, yeah, not a lot of models for that.
Right. So it's brought the attention of social scientists and historians. Like, this is a puzzle, actually.
Yeah.
So Grundtvig's idea was that when he was a young man and starting thinking about things, the education system in Denmark, of course, was very, very narrowly confined to this elite, and it was all in foreign languages. It was in Latin, right,
mm-hmm.
but also French and German, sort of a bit, because it was a Lutheran country. They would read
yeah.
the Bible in German and things like that. French was kind of the international language of culture, and it was not in Danish, and Danish was the language of the peasants, right? And it was,
right.
you know, it was looked down upon, and along with all the other things that the peasants did, folk arts, you know, the folklore and the Danish foods and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you wouldn't want to be involved with that if you were a person of culture and refinement.
Right.
And yet, so if you have this, you know, democracy, you know, starting with the American and French revolutions is starting to be, you know, clearly the wave of the future. How do you get to a situation where all of those despised, looked down upon peasants are, you know, stakeholders in the society? And so Grundtvig kind of gestates this idea of the school for life, which he calls a folk high school. And folk is, you know, the people, right?
People. Yeah.
And they're schools for life because they are integrated with the living culture, with the language, the vernacular language
mm-hmm.
of the Danish people,
yes.
And with the kind of traditions and folk arts and just the life of the people who have lived on the land. And
right. Not saying that these are lesser or that these, you know, you aspire to be away from these, but that these are a valuable underpinning of your culture and
yeah.
to lift them up, not just the people out of them.
And to build a new national identity out of that materials,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that is you know, the folk high school, building a sense of peoplehood. Before that, you had very local identities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was true over most of the world. And then you also had this very stratified class identity, right? You didn't have a sense, we are all Danes, we're all
mm-hmm.
people here. And so how do you create that identity? And it is out of the, you know, the common language and the common traditions. As an example, Grundtvig was one of the very early people to, like, take the Norse myths, the old kind of, you know, he was a Lutheran minister, right? But he was, like, promoting the telling of these stories about Thor and Loki and
yeah.
Odin and these stories as a key part of developing national identity and of, you know, building a sense of peoplehood, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the folk schools, you know, they gestate out of this idea. And other people really took it and ran with it. And between the 1840s and to the end of the 1860s, you had maybe ultimately like 60 or 70 of these schools across Denmark, a country with, you know, not with less than 2 million people at that time, were started. And these were
yeah,
almost
like
all
the size of Wisconsin or population.
It is today, actually.
Today,
and
okay.
Yeah,
so and
at
so
that
even
time,
then it was,
yeah.
Yeah, smaller. So
this like, was you know, these were mostly, the early folk schools were mostly the projects of educators who
mm-hmm.
basically would have a farm, bought a farm, or given a farm, and the teacher and his, you know, his wife would, like, set up in a farmhouse, and they would and bring in a group of young people, usually the children
yeah.
of the peasants, and they would live together for a semester, like often like during the winter, right, in the
mm-hmm.
off season from farming,
yes.
and they would have meals together, they would read books, and that might be the Bible, it might be French literature, it might be philosophy, it might be, you know, different flavors in different places. They would talk a bit about farming skills. They would, you know, they would sing a lot of songs. Singing is really important part of this. Mm-hmm. But above all, they would have a temporary community, a very egalitarian community where people would have, they would eat together, they would discuss ideas and topics together. They would, yeah, it's the art of being a member of an adult community was being practiced in these little households. And really, I see in this like very, something very akin to what we're doing at the micro colleges here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So what happened was, you know, from the beginning of the 19th century, when Denmark was one of the poorest countries in Europe at the bottom end of a lot of these international conflicts, by the first decade of the 20th century, Denmark was one of the richest countries in Europe.
Wow.
And it wasn't because they discovered oil or conquered any big territories, anything like that. It was human development. It was it was bringing up the all the people in society and having a sense of social solidarity, which allows the creation of a social safety net of, you know, and really a sense of belonging that allows people to take care of each other.
Yeah, these were probably people in that feudal time who didn't leave their village, didn't travel widely, didn't have a concept of the many villages or the many people over this whole country. And so they would go to this school where they would maybe there would be people from, you know, regional villages in the area. So you kind of see like, oh, you are me, I am you. You know, we're all in this place together.
That was an important piece of it. People came to these folk schools from all over the country. And then they went back home. And it was really a noted phenomenon that the people, the young people who had gone off to the folk school and they'd spent maybe three or four months there max.
Yeah.
They would go back home to their home village and very quickly they would become the leaders in those communities.
Yeah.
They would look to because they had learned to speak confidently. They had learned a little bit more about, you know, kind of the theory and practice of agriculture. They would be called upon to be represent the community towards the government. And then also almost the same time and closely connected was the development of cooperatives, you know, economic farming cooperatives. And pretty quickly, most of the farming in the country became connected with co-ops. And that was many times led by these folk high school graduates.
Yes. Yeah. Not unrelatedly, they probably saw that this coming together in this collective intentional way had benefits.
Yeah. These are, you know, people with a sense of initiative, a sense of autonomy, and ability of confidence to speak and act in the world. And that was, so these schools were not granting any certificates. There was no exams. Mm-hmm. It was not credentialing. It was not like vocational in that sense.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you think about development, how we have a you know, an underdeveloped society. We're going to send them some people to train them in, you know, computer skills or, you know, something like this. This is really inner development and, you know, and development of people's social skills and their thinking skills and their, you know, and also their sense of just personhood. And, and that was, you know, the human being as the kind of the focus of education is core to here.
Yeah. And it's very interesting because you think of a lot of education comes in and is like, you need to learn these outside things to be lifted up. And that's like saying like, you're a whole person. Let's teach you how to like cultivate that and bring your skills to the surface, bring your way of thinking, your, you know, personal strengths to the surface. And that probably, I can imagine that being more powerful and having more long lasting ripple effects than kind of an outside prescriptive solution being like brought in and like kind of foisted upon maybe not so willing population or
right. Starting with a celebration of your, you know, your cultural heritage, your language. Yeah. And that's a really important piece of it. And I think that's how you get to, you know, by a couple steps to the folk schools here, right? Folk arts and crafts, like those are things that are practiced in those early folk high schools, along with the kind of the more, you know, whole person education.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, firstly, I see you brought a book in, and I know that there's a couple books that if people want to kind of read a little bit more about this, do you want to give the name of this book and another one that maybe really kind of captures that kind of historical context? And then we can maybe go into like, what does this look like now in Denmark or how these schools like still exist or function?
So books, people are interested in this. I mean, one thing I'd recommend is actually going to the Micro College podcast. There's four or five interviews there that trace this story from different perspectives.
Yeah.
There's one interview with a folk school, a recent, young person who went to a folk high school in Denmark, and a couple of educators, and then also two interviews with Lena Rachel Anderson, mm-hmm. who actually was a participant in this conference that I was at. She's the author of a book called The Nordic Secret, which tells the story and also puts some kind of philosophical theory behind what was happening there. That would be a good recommendation, a recent text. And then the other book here is a book written by an anthropologist in the 1980s. And it's a book called The Land of the Living by Stephen Borish, which is really talking about Denmark in general but specifically the role of the folk high schools in this modernization process that uniquely happened in Denmark, and how it looks, how it's contributed to the way that Denmark looked, at least in the 1980s.
Yeah, up through the 80s, which, it hasn't slid backwards as far as I can tell.
It's a cultural anthropologist, so there's like lots of interesting things about like how are people actually interacting on the street and at the home and things like that, which is always fun when you go to a foreign country.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
So, but this is not just a historical thing. This is not just something that happened, Band-Aid, we solved it, and now they go forward. Like, this is a modern thing. This
Absolutely.
One school that you went to visit for this conference is not alone in existing still. It's
not at all. Yeah. So that mostly what I was talking about so far was the 19th century. Definitely continues on to today. There are between 70 and 80 folk high schools in Denmark alone today, and through much of the 20th century into the 21st century, it's been something like 20 or 25% of the population in Denmark has participated in one of these schools at some point. And sometimes they do it at an older age, much as we are seeing as well with some people in the Driftless Folk School, and people are seeking out a little bit of a gap year wherever they are in their life, and that happens there too.
Yeah.
But also there's a really robust folk high school movement in Norway that is getting some attention recently. In Sweden, Finland, like these countries, really took this model and adapted it to their own context. And indeed, other places in the world. That was an interesting thing about this conference. But maybe just in Denmark specifically, as the 20th century rolled along and the crises that came up in world politics and events happened, and in the environment and so forth, there have been new folk schools that have been founded in response to those.
This
conference was hosted by one of those. This was the International People's College, which is unique in Denmark. This is an English language folk high school. There's by law, folk high schools in Denmark receive kind of 50% of their funding from the government for students, mm-hmm. and those students can actually come from wherever.
Yeah.
Actually, they can be international as well. But by law, most of them are required to do most of their programming in Danish because of this folk tradition.
Yes.
There's an exception for the International People's College, which is English language.
Okay.
And also its population is different. So it's about 100 students at a time. These basically semester programs. About 20% or so are Danish, but the rest of the students come from around the world, and they are this kind of a regional quota. So they'll have 20 or 25% of people from East Asia, some from other parts of Europe, some from Africa, and the Americas in different kind of proportions. There's a lot of interest there, actually, from Japan and from South Korea, so they're well represented. And they said, they could fill it with Japanese students if they didn't have that quota system.
Makes sense to do that because if you're going to be international, you really to try and kind of have that global balance makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So the International People's College was started in the aftermath of World War I. The founder, so Denmark was neutral in World War I, of course, hugely impacted by that going on
in
the war.
Right in the middle of it all.
The founder of the International People's College was a Danish educator, Peter Manish, who during the war was in spent time in England. And there's an interesting back and forth between the Danish folk high schools and education in England. So he experienced some of Quaker based school in England where there were conscientious objectors who who had been, you know, in the war, and you know, there was one particular one who had had, you know, lost his legs or something, and then had continued to work, and specifically was like caring for German soldiers, and so that was inspiring to to Peter Manish, and he created the International People's College in the aftermath of World War I in 1921 as a place to really consciously bring together people, to begin with, like British and German, you know, young men who had recently been murdering each other. And then, you know, eventually people from other places in the world to do this folk high school education as a explicitly like peace studies and international relations and, you know, and that kind of activism.
Yeah. Just have some really intentional deprogramming.
Yeah. Well, and what do you do at a place like that? So that brings the question of curriculum. I mean, I think it, again, resonates really strongly because at the beginning and to a certain degree still today, like practical physical labor, like gardening and maintaining the grounds, was a key part of what they were doing. And apparently Peter Manish was like a real, like workaholic, and he would, you know, there was like, you know, many hours a day, 8 hours a day or something of what they were doing was, you know, a lot of it was hands-on, you know, labor stuff.
Yeah. So
that was interesting. But anyway, it has continued down to today. And, you know, as a result of it being English language, it has become a node for this idea to spread elsewhere in the world, right? And that was really on show at this event. We had people, we had a well-represented group from the United States, also from Canada. There were people there from Japan and from South Korea. There were representatives from elsewhere in Europe, including Germany, Austria, and the former Soviet Union. There were several people from Ukraine, from Lithuania. There was folks from China and Syria, right? So a really interesting mix of people.
Very broad.
Of these are, you know, had, were, or had connections to people who had actually attended the International People's College. But what they were doing, you know, with this idea elsewhere was, you know, was quite different from place to place. So a well-represented group there, maybe three or four people, were from the Highlander School, which is, you know, along with John C. Campbell, one of the first folk high schools, folk schools in the United States, started in Tennessee in the 1930s as really as a center for organizing and, you know, social action. And so that was Miles Horton, one of the founders of the Highlander Folk School, had spent time in Denmark at the International People's College in its first decade or so, and was, you know, seeking a model of organizing an education to bring back to Appalachia, where he was from, and so that was the origin of the Highlander Folk School. And there's maintained a strong relationship between Highlander and Denmark, and the director of the Highlander Folk School, now called the Highlander Research and Education Center. In Tennessee, was there Dr. Alan Steele, and he was the keynote speaker. And today, I mean, the Highlander Folk School was a, you know, most famously a key kind of location for the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. You know, it was, you know, very controversial. Actually, was like closed down. You know, was burned down. Right, this is a place that was really in the you know, the Jim Crow kind of South, was a place that was, it was a center of real. Of vegetation, and you know, it really continues that tradition today. It's a place where people are doing labor organizing and migrant rights and things like that. And so, but that's, so that's part of the folk school umbrella as well, right?
Right.
Down to today, and it might seem quite different from, you know, learning spoon carving and but it's really not, right? Because the mission, you know, you bring people together, you know, and you're building community. You're talking about what's important. And, you know, that really is the core. It goes back to the origins of the folk high school movement.
Yeah.
So as an example, one of the key speakers was Jennifer DeCoste, who's the founder of an organization in Atlanta, Canada called Life Schoolhouse. And they, you know, for the last decade have been doing folk school and craft type classes in people's homes, and it's now established a model that's has many centers across Canada. And so, again, it's you know, people are skill sharing, they're learning from each other, but in the process, they're forming social ties. They're going into each other's homes. They quickly became a, you know, a way for people to find out, oh, you're actually having a hard time finding enough to eat. And so that became sort of a food pantry, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, a little bit of a, you're building that kind of a dense set of social relationships through craft, through hands, you know, and through, you know, education that is, again, it's really, you know, the roots are very similar.
Yeah.
And so maybe the third example I'd share from this was there was some very, you know, it's inspiring two or three people from Ukraine, you know, where there's some alums of the IPC who, and people inspired by this model who have started a folk school in part of Ukraine that had recently been occupied by the Russians and then recaptured. And so they've built a folk school there, and they're in addition to Ukrainian culture, here's a situation not too different from Denmark in the early 19th century.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's vision there of this is like part of the resilience and the rebuilding of Ukraine in the wake of this war, is that, you know, a whole wave of folk high schools being founded.
Yeah. Wow. That feels like, you know, kind of coming together after kind of being fractured in a way that war does, is where you know, you lose members of your community through, you know, going to other places that are safe or just, mm-hmm. you know, having to hide, essentially, that you can kind of have this time to connect and heal and share and, you know, reestablish kind of a connection to your culture.
Yeah. And a culture in the case of Ukraine, which is, you know, part of the core issue is, you know, is being challenged. It's very like independent existence.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Ukraine.
For a long time, not just now. It's just again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's, I'm glad that they were able to make it and share their stories and their experience and what they're doing. So you said that, this was the second, kind of attempt at this gathering. Is this going to become an annual thing, or is there, you know, is this, obviously, you probably made a lot of connections, mm-hmm. Met a lot of really inspiring folks, and it's not always easy to, you know, travel internationally, but it seems like there's a lot of benefits from kind of meeting together like this.
Yeah. So there was a gathering, I think it was 2019, I think. I don't know the exact, I was not there, that was organized by the Danish Association of Folk High Schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of the participants had been at that event. But that didn't happen after that again. And the Danish Association decided like that wasn't necessarily their job and their business. But then this gathering was organized by one of the faculty at the International People's College, actually a person who's been on the MicroCollege podcast.
Okay.
Dr. Julie Shackelford, who's done a lot of work to connect kind of personally all the people in this global movement. And so she, you know, with the support of International People's College, organized this event kind of on her own initiative and hosted it there, brought together, you know, a really remarkable set of the key people, including people I had talked to on the podcast or knew about, and have them all there in the same place. It was very, very powerful. Lane and Rachel Anderson, Jennifer DeCoste, the folks from Highlander, also Don Murphy from the Folk School Alliance. These were all people who were really excited to have them in the same place. And so, you know, there's not an organization that's leading this. It is, you know, and there's not necessarily a plan for it to happen again, but I think there's a lot of momentum there. And especially with, you know, the expansion of this model in new places like Eastern Europe and also the Middle East and East Asia, like I think that's, it'd be a good idea at least. And I think there's a lot of interest in that happening.
Yeah, it seems like this time in history where we have to be very intentional about like holding community and fostering community, because there's a lot of ability to be fractured and a lot of divisiveness kind of being pushed and preached.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you can kind of go with that flow, or you can like intentionally resist that. And it feels like what these schools are doing, what these schools have done historically, is kind of resisting kind of this drift in the other direction, is like, no, we are going to come together. We are going to, you know, maybe have some hard conversations or live in community with people we don't always agree with, but we're going to do it, and we're going to do it again and again. And there are benefits from there, massive benefits from that, not just in that like uplifting of the entire Danish population, but just seeing our common fellow, seeing a common human being and realizing that we all have a lot more in common than not. But when you kind of drift off into your own little bubbles in your circles, that's easy to kind of miss. And you know, even just like the folk school classes, we've got the Spoon Gathering coming up. Well, by the time this plays, that actually will have happened already. But but it's a chance to just sit down with folks and work on something, you know, and share that common small struggle of like, oh, I'm struggling with this craft that I'm making. I'm, you know, whatever it is, foraging, whatever, like it's there's more sharing than divisiveness and giving that more of a platform, which takes intention.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think, my most recent Driftless Folk School experience was this yesterday, teaching a chicken butchering class, which is something that I do that every year at least once.
That's a big one too. That's
so I love those. And that's the Driftless Folk School has really, centered those really practical, how to feed yourself, mm-hmm. Type of classes, how to shelter yourself, how to clothe yourself, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
This homesteading skills here, which I think has strong roots in the history of folk schools, but they also have the capacity to bring people together across all kinds of boundaries because everyone eats.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
I think at this moment, like there are many different kinds of people who are interested in raising, their own chickens and mm-hmm. their own garden. Mm-hmm. And that's, you can bring people around that and they can discover their shared humanity. And, that's something I love about the chicken butchering class, especially because people do come to that because they really have something they want to learn.
Yeah. And they're also maybe often being pushed a little beyond their natural comfort zone as well.
Yeah. This particular class we had yesterday, there was a wonderful an African American man there from out of the area who came, who was very excited to learn about chicken butchering because he said, yeah, my grandparents, they came out of the South and they left all that behind, meaning all the mm-hmm. farm skills, mm-hmm. right? And so this kind of palpable sense of loss there. And so it was an exciting thing to like connect and, he's working as a nurse and like he's living in the city and it's like, but this is a way to like to touch base with that. It's a heritage that happened somewhere else maybe, but it's also like these skills are those allowed someone to connect with that in a really practical way. And he said, I've got two young kids and he wanted to have pictures and like my kids aren't going to believe I'm doing this, but I'm really excited to tell them about it. Right. So that generational transmission was so exciting to experience.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of patching together that gap from when those skills were not transmitted.
Right.
And now like there's a bridge there to like have a more of an understanding with your elders or your ancestors of like how they sustained and how they survived and the things they had to do. And then can take that going forward and then share that chicken then with his children because everyone gets a take-home chicken, I think, at the end of the chicken butchering class.
Totally. And some gizzards and, some feet.
Yeah.
These folks even took home some heads. That was a new one, but yeah.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, and several people did. It was so then the conversations of the other people there were all, actually quite similar to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's something like there's a woman, older woman who had, she actually had hunting experience but had never done chicken butchering. And, there was things there from people who were just thinking again. Usually there's a few people who are like, I'm about to buy land in the country and I want to learn this as the first thing. So there's a real commonality of experience that and the conversation that flows from any kind of a practical learning thing like that is really beautiful.
Yeah. Well, and I think that folk school does a great job of many varieties of things and then the singing as well is kind of has this other like layer of there's something about singing in community and you say that you do that at Thoreau College.
Yep. Sing every day. That is perhaps the most common thing among these folk schools and folk school inspired things around the world. Like singing is core. There's one, one of the participants there was a woman from South Korea, who actually led our singing each morning there out of the Danish folk high school songbook, which is the most popular, most sold book in Denmark.
Oh, okay.
ahead of the Bible.
Yeah.
And it consists, a bunch of them are songs in Danish by Grundtvig, as is the actually hymnal in the Lutheran church in Denmark. But the book also includes, and the ones that we mostly sang were, the Beatles and Bob Dylan and then like ABBA and things like this.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Is the global songbook of things that people can sing.
Right.
So, and then we also, I was there with one of our Thoreau College alums, Tom Vassal, who's from Brazil, who's a wonderful song leader. And so we led a bunch of our like community singing things we've learned from Liz Rog and things that we sing every day at Thoreau College. So there was a sharing of songs there. And then, the Highlander Folk School, right, their mm-hmm. history there, mm-hmm. and one of their contributions to the civil rights movement was, Pete Seeger and many of the civil rights leaders there were, they kind of workshopped We Shall Overcome and a bunch of the other, like the soundtrack of the civil rights movement at the Highlander Folk School. And, it was a key thing to have your protest songs.
I don't think anybody can hear We Shall Overcome without having like hair stand up on the back of their neck and just kind of feeling that energy that comes kind of with that song and like all the people who have sang it and all the struggles that it has been sung in the face of. I think that's that particular song, I think, for Americans is probably a really good example of kind of how music can have that cultural resonance that we can feel on like a deeper level.
Yeah.
At least speaking for myself, I guess, in that moment. But
So that goes right back to the very first folk high schools. They spent significant time every day singing together. And that, how do you build the people? You sing together and you harmonize.
Mm-hmm. 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 That is, with a little bit of an assumption, but I can see singing going back before, definitely before like books and like written word, but like almost maybe before language.
Yeah.
Was singing.
But as with chicken butchering, there's a break, right, in our culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Music is something you hear on the radio or on your recordings or whatever, and mm-hmm. or in a concert. And maybe you sing Happy Birthday, but that's about it. Like, I don't sing, right?
Yeah.
It's something that many people will say. And that's, I think, it's so important to, I don't sing, I don't cook, I don't draw, I don't garden, I don't, I don't know the plants and animals. Like, those are breaks in cultural and knowledge transmission and shared kind of, shared life that I think the folk school really is involved with breaking.
And breaks that are just in the past 100 years after eternity before that.
Right.
And so you kind of have to see, like, do those fractures in culture and what was historically culture, made up culture, is that part of our kind of our meaning crisis that I know we've discussed before in other contexts, and Thoreau College directly tackles that kind of meaning crisis. And maybe, folk schools and these kind of folk high schools, and they kind of are starting to repair and try and heal that, mm-hmm. or weave those threads back together. It all came down when the radio came on. Well, don't turn this radio station off, though. Not this one. Well, Jacob, thank you so much for joining me. This is really interesting kind of stuff to think about. Think about, these schools existing, how they're popping up in other countries, how people are intentionally stepping away from divisiveness and moving into these actions of like building and healing and connecting community.
Mm-hmm.
And
for me, it was a sense of, as we talked about earlier, there's sometimes in this work, different phases, there was a very small number of people working on the folk school or on Thoreau College. And, mm-hmm. and if it is a little group, it was felt just in this place, right?
Yeah.
So to go to an event like this that's global in nature, I was really filled with great sense of appreciation and just like enthusiasm that, hey, this is a really a broad global movement. People are seeking and finding and building things with a lot of resonance with each other. And so there's a sense of like there is a commonality, and there we have colleagues, we have peers, we have fellow collaborators all around the world on this work. And I think it really also, I think people going out and traveling wherever you go, take a moment to figure out what interesting things are going where you travel, right? Go to your, cultural or like a beach vacation or whatever, but there is probably somebody doing folk arts. There's someone mm-hmm. doing crafts. Mm-hmm. There's someone doing, regenerative agriculture. There's someone, they're out there. And those are really powerful connections and a really interesting way to travel.
And ripple. They ripple.
Yeah.
All these kind of things seem to ripple out. You said that many of the people there kind of had connections back to this school, but they took that and like you know, now it's growing in its other little places. So
The International People's College in particular has had this effect because it is so, you know, it brings people from all over. Many people go out from this and I want to do this back in my home country. I want to like, you know, I was mentioning that the woman from South Korea who was doing the singing, she started an organization in South Korea that is basically teaching, leading song circles in people's homes in South Korea. Right?
Oh, beautiful.
Out of this folk school impulse.
Yeah, well, just as those original students went back into their small communities and villages and became kind of leaders, that same thing is happening on a global scale. And and I think that as Thoreau College becomes an institution that is growing more and more and starts to put decades behind it, that those ripples will also become evident, as they already are in their own small ways in various places. So very exciting to hear about, very exciting to have this conversation. It just fills me with a lot of like hope and enthusiasm to kind of watch these things happen and to know that like there are many people out there doing good works in small ways and in small communities, but those good works spread. And the time is right for this. So thank you so much for joining me here on the Folk School Radio Hour. And coming up here, we will talk about some folk school classes coming up this weekend and in the next few weeks as well. Okay, so looking forward here in the next few weeks at the Driftless Folk School, we've got some really fun classes coming up. Saturday the 4th, we've got Off-Grid Solar and Batteries with John Passy. Fall mushroom foraging with Andy Reisdorf. So that'll be really exciting. Some good fall fungus. We've also got fall foraging with Nicholas Wazi Gale. So some other wild greens, roots, and nuts, things like that in the woods. And then October 11th, we've got Reed Market Baskets with Martha Bush. So that's very cool. And then the same day, October 11th, there's Beginning Chip Carving with John Carlson. John Carlson is just so much fun to take a class with. Such beautiful geometric carvings with just little flicks of a knife. So very fun. And then that evening we have, on that October 11th, there is an autumn stargazing with Megan Eberhardt, and that's going to be very cool. Laying out dark, hope for a good clear night, and see what there is to see with those stars. Then October 15th, there is a 5-day timber framing class. It starts on the 15th through the 19th. And that is just such a beautiful quintessential folk skill. And then from the garden, herbal medicine making with Linda Conroy. And that's kind of for winter things to help kind of boost your immune system as we move indoors in the winter time. And then Linda's also going to be teaching herbs for topical applications, so salves, infused oils, lotions, things like that. And that is coming up on the 19th of October. And we also have a cooking class with Frank Wildingway on that same day of the 19th, doing congee and dal and some other really just hearty foods. Frank makes good hearty foods. And we've got a Thursday class there towards the end of October on the 23rd, the Intro to Oxen, which is just absolutely amazing. Amazing to see Annika Baird working with the oxen, seeing just their immense size and strength, and as well as gentleness, and just very cool to participate in. Then there's axe, saw, and knife use for bushcraft and woodland building. So Nicholas Wazi Gale teaching that on October 25th. And then wool needle felting with Martha Bush, and that is at the very first Saturday there in November. And it looks like maybe making some sweet little ornaments or something like that out of needle felting. So a lot of good things coming up here at the Folk School. Check out our website, driftlessfolkschool.org, for an up-to-date list of all the classes that are coming up. Sign up for classes, get onto our waiting list. Check out our socials on Instagram at Driftless Folk School. And yeah, come on out to some of our barn dances. I know those are going to be getting scheduled for winter time. Maybe we'll do one in January to kick off our 20th year. So yeah, pop onto the website, and that's where you'll find all of the happenings. And have a beautiful evening, folks.